This is Gary Wakefield, and you're listening to Queer Life Stories. Our podcast is recorded in La Truita, home of the Palawa people. We acknowledge the traditional owners of country, their diversity, histories and knowledge, and their continuing connections to land and community. We also acknowledge LGBTIQA+ advocates, friends and allies whose courage and strengths have helped to make this a more just society for lesbian, gay, bisexual, gender diverse and intersex populations and their families.
My name's Rowan Myers, I'm 34 and I am, yes, I am demisexual, pan-romantic. I am non-binary, trans, generally queer. One of those identities where you have the fine china identity you get out for the people who get it. There's layers more underneath those labels. I had a deceptively idyllic sort of or organised upbringing. So my parents have been married now for 45-ish years. I've got three older siblings, two older brothers, one older sister, and idolised my older brothers, did not get along with my older sister, absolute warfare when we had to share a room for the first 16 years of our lives. Yeah, and both my parents were teachers, so we had a, I guess, comparatively privileged upbringing in the sense that we had parents who knew about child development, who cared a lot, who were really education and learning oriented to understand what was important when, you know, when we were quite young, we maybe didn't have very much money to go around, but they always had sort of the skills and capacity to make sure we got what was important. Mm-hmm. Retrospectively, that wasn't quite true because it turned out that I was undiagnosed autistic and ADHD and ended up with CPTSD from an otherwise ordinary childhood. But on the surface of it, we were the sort of family where other families would say, oh, your kids are so well behaved and they're all doing so well at school. My older siblings are amazing. You know, growing up, my oldest brother was the certified genius of the family. He's a climate scientist in the British Antarctic, running the British Antarctic Survey these days. My other brother does emergency services mapping, saving Tasmania from fire, flood, biosecurity, whatever happens to be the emergency of the day. And my sister is, she's a high school teacher of maths and science, but she's also always been a, you know, pretty extraordinary athlete. So growing up, she was captaining the state women's soccer team and all sorts of things. And I was the strange little black sheep following along behind.
You said that, like, from the surface it was idyllic, but what was your experience of it?
My experience was that I was pretty sure I was an alien and I didn't know why I wasn't like everyone else. I have this memory seared into my brain from when I was in prep and I first started going to school. My sister had been so excited that her ostensible little sister was coming to school finally. But I was not the social butterfly she hoped I would be. And I have this memory of after the first day of school, her saying to me scathingly, "Why can't you be like all the other little girls?" Spoilers, wasn't a little girl. Well, I was little, not a girl.
That could be the problem.
It was one of the problems. The problem in question that day was actually that I was autistic and didn't know how to make facial expressions, and so I this terrible grimace I would put on because it was my best approximation of smiling from my little rote learning brain saying, "This is how you smile." Took a while to get that one.
Was that a diagnosis? Was that in childhood or was that?
No. I still haven't been formally diagnosed with a level of autism. That's something I'm looking into, and I only got my ADHD diagnosis last year in July, so at age 33. My goodness, getting the right medication turns down the difficulty setting on life several levels. When I was in high school, my mum did say, she was, you know, a specialist teacher at the time focusing on neurodivergent kids, and she said, yeah, I'm pretty sure you're neurodivergent and maybe so am I. But we didn't do anything about it. There was too much, I guess, stigma attached to this label. We weren't disabled. We were perfectly ordinary and normal, and as far as anyone was concerned, I was a skinny, blonde, 16-year-old, high-achieving, academic, sporty girl called Susan, who was also a Christian. Totally straight, totally cis. Nothing to see here. Mm. Perfection at all times. Do not look beneath the veil.
So that kind of Stepford kind of living, is that something that your parents forced on you?
I wouldn't say they ever forced anything on us. They were always actually unusually proactive in getting our consent and input on things. Like when I was in early childhood and my teacher said, oh, we should put this kid into a gifted program, my parents went to me and asked me if I wanted to be in the gifted program, and I said no, so they said no.
Okay.
I have no memory of that. Had a lot of different feelings about that over the years, but it was probably more important that I learned to socialise with my peers. But no, our parents never forced anything on us, but I was a strange kid and I was really easily wounded by the disapproval of others, which, you know, is known as rejection-sensitive dysphoria, and I just wanted to make everyone proud, and that meant I needed to be perfect. And that was what society told me was perfect.
Yeah.
You've got to be good at everything all the time. You've got to be blonde. You've got to be pretty. You've got to be straight. You've got to be cis. You've got to be interested in sex when you get to high school and start having boyfriends, because that's the rules and that's how that goes. And I followed the rules, and that's how it went. You know, that was the plan I had for my life, and I was going to follow it come hell or high water.
And was that because you wanted to just fit into the culture at the time?
Subconsciously, I had a lot different going on to what I knew consciously. I was a very strong-willed child, and I applied that mostly to repression. So I had no idea about my identity, because I was so committed to this, you know, this image of what was the best. But there were hints and signs. You know, in high school, I did a negotiated study on, at the time it was called gender identity disorder. Just a, you know, passing interest. Totally not about anything. I had a lot of teachers who tried to tell me I was gay, and I said, no. All my friends are gay, but I'm not gay. Again, signs we should have noticed.
Was there a lot of gay or queer representation at school, or?
No, none at all. I was very privileged to be at a school that was big enough to have enough weird kids for us to band together. in fact, we were so weird that the name of our group, which was the Fish Club, became a byword at that school for the weird kids for about a decade and a half afterwards. We're quite proud of that. And yeah, because it was a group made of kids who didn't fit the norm and couldn't fit the norm. Within that group, we could all be weird in different ways and just sort of accept each other at face value. And yeah, I credit that group and those people with my survival for the first 25 odd years of my life. They were and are wonderful people, and I'm still very close with most of them now.
That's amazing. Yeah.
We kept each other going.
Yeah, and still do, it sounds like.
Well, look, in an all-girls high school, it doesn't matter who you are. If you don't fit the norm, it's trench warfare.
Yeah. So what about when did you first kind of know about queerness? When did that sort of – did you see that in the media, or was there family friends that might have identified as queer?
We had an estranged aunt who was very infrequently mentioned, who was a trans woman, but she was only ever referred to as either with derogatory terms or as, you know, an uncle. So I didn't really know about that for a long time. and I grew up in various churches, so I don't think I had any models of what queerness was other than my friends.
Yeah.
I never read any of that sort of material. I was very sheltered, not intentionally, but just practically. And so, no, I learned it from my friends. Yeah. Turns out the gay is catching. No. Where I think it really started, I guess, manifesting out of my brain into reality was that, like so many groups of weird kids, we played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. And in those settings, with those trusted friends, you could explore parts of yourself that you didn't, you know, feel safe to look at in the light of day. And I played a lot of male or weirdly androgynous characters. Can't figure out why. I also spent a few years going to, you know, the gay straight alliance type clubs and the queer alliance type clubs as an ally, of course.
Of course.
Just such a good ally.
Such a good ally.
I think a lot of us know that particular trajectory.
I think so. You mentioned the church a couple of times. How much of an influence was the church on your growing up?
That's a tricky question. So I mentioned earlier that my mum thought that she was neurodivergent, and I don't know whether they'll listen to this. I'm quite certain both mum and dad are in different ways. And dad's special interest has always been his faith. He's very passionate, very dedicated to being ethical and moral and self-consistent in service to others, service to the community, and to doing good, I guess, in that sense of what religion is meant to be. And we bounced from church to church quite a bit as when I was younger, I think in part because we could never find a church that really captured our what we were looking for in terms of sort of that those ethical frameworks. And we weren't forced to go to church. That was another thing. My parents asked for consent. They said, you don't have to go to church. We're going to go to church, but, you know, that's your choice. Once you're old enough to stay home on your own, you can stay home on your own if that's what's happening. But it was really clear that they wanted us to go to church because they wanted us to be good people. So I went to church.
Mm. It's interesting to me that people that go to church think that morality can only come from church.
My dad and I have spent many years now, particularly since I came out, we had a tradition for several years of a Thursday afternoon coffee catch-up where we would go out together and get a treat and talk about that. You know, he would often say to me, I don't know how you do it, you know. I don't understand how you keep hope in the world and in people when you don't have this toolbox of knowing that God's there for you. And I'm like, yeah, I would love to have that particular crutch, but my brain rejected it as a teenager, and you can't choose to believe something.
No.
You can want to believe something, but you can't really force yourself. And, yeah, I have put a lot of thought into that over the years because, you know, when I left Christianity in quite a violent process from my internal perspective, I spent a lot of time going, how do I make sure I'm a good person? But yeah, service to others is not a denominational thing.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think religion has the shouldn't be gatekeeping morality.
No. My dad likes to say that I'm a Christian who doesn't believe in Jesus. I disagree with him, and he says, it's okay, I don't need you to agree with me. he's an unusual man, and I love him dearly.
So going back to being younger and coming to terms with your identity, how did that first kind of manifest for you?
So, you know, I was in high school and all my friends were gay and I was the token straight. And then I got to college and I went, oh, you know, I'm probably just heteroflexible and a really good ally. There's just some people that I really like, but, you know, I'll flirt with all my ostensibly same gender friends, but it's not real. And then I admitted that maybe I was attracted to women, but I only dated boys. I only dated men, you know. Doubled down on that, got engaged to a man. And, yeah, I was willing to concede that I was bi, but never going to explore it, and that I was, you know, just going to stay a cis woman in a relationship with a cis man. And then that engagement failed spectacularly at the same time as I developed a neuroimmune disability. I was very, very sick for a few years. I lost pretty much all of the aspects of my life that I'd hinged my identity on. So I had to rebuild from nothing. And when you rebuild from nothing, you start to look at the assumptions you've made about yourself. And it, I basically was, you know, sitting at my computer at 2 a.m., you know, at some point in the following year going, who the heck am I? What am I doing here? What am I assuming about myself? And I realized, am I assuming I'm a girl? Oh dear, I am. That's a problem. And so it was probably only 3 months between me realizing that I was non-binary and coming out to my family. And to their credit, like I said, they're very much about, you know, their kids' consent and self-direction. And I sat down with them and I said, hey, I'm going to show you some graphs. And I explained to them concepts of non-binary gender using graphs and data and science. And they said, huh, that's new. Would have been easier if you were just gay.
Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it would have, Mum. It would have been so much easier, but it's not the world we're living in. And look, to her credit, you know, she took me to get my name changed, you know, not long after I told her that I was non-binary. She paid for the name change certificate. My parents championed, you know, with all my siblings, no, you should use the correct pronouns, you know. You've got to get it right. And they both carried that out into the rest of their lives. They're not people who like to make a fuss. They're not like people who like to stand out or you know, make speeches or attract attention. But, you know, my parents wrote a letter to Parliament that was read out on the floor of Parliament during our gender law reforms saying, look, we were wrong about our kid, but now they've transitioned, we can see that they are happy in a way that we could never have made happen otherwise. They bared their souls and I guess, you know, their I guess, parental failings, for lack of a better term, because they didn't know. And, yeah, they've been amazing. You know, every time I throw something bizarre at them, they just go, whew, okay, show us the science. Cool, yep, that's a thing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Which, yeah, I'm so incredibly lucky in that sense. But, yeah, I first figured out that I was not straight. And then it was about 8 years before I figured out that I was not cis. And then I think it was about another 8 years before I figured out that I wasn't allosexual, that I was actually asexual and that that was a thing.
Yeah.
Because even in all of those, you know, queer friendship groups and queer support groups and, you know, the quite intense queer advocacy I've done over the years, no one ever really mentioned asexuality.
Yeah.
And to this day, I carry a whole lot of internalized stigma around that one that I've been able to work through for the others. That's the hard one because, you know, we have this shame about who we are because we think we're letting somebody down. And then we realize that, you know, if we come out as trans and live as our authentic selves, that's not letting anyone down. That's being good to other people. But coming out as asexual, you know that everyone's going to look at your partner and think questions to themselves that you can't answer. So I have a wonderful spouse as well. Again, very lucky in my interpersonal relationships. Em and I have been together for 7.5 years. And they're allosexual, right? They have an ordinary experience of sexual attraction. And I don't. And I feel really uncomfortable talking about my asexuality in general because I know that it reflects on our relationship, not just me.
Hmm. I think the term you used when you introduced yourself was demisexual. Do you want to explain that for anyone listening who might not know what that is?
Yeah. I don't even know if that's accurate anymore, frankly.
okay.
But, yeah, so demisexual is where I guess I first started identifying on the ace spectrum. Demisexual is someone who ordinarily doesn't experience sexual attraction, but with a really intense emotional bond with someone they do and can. And so that's, I guess, occasionally sexual, not in the typical way, not very frequently.
Sure.
But there's sort of other dimensions to asexuality as well. There's also, are you sex favourable? Are you sex neutral? Are you sex averse? Which is different to being sex positive. Which is, I guess, because a lot of ace people do have sex and have sexual relationships. They don't necessarily experience the attraction, but that doesn't mean they can't have fun.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if you're a sex averse person, you might have, you know, quite an intense physiological aversion to anything that you sort of perceive as sexual. Mm. And between my own gender fluidity, meaning that my dysphoria about various body parts changes unpredictably, and my unpredictable disability, meaning, you know, I may or may not have pain or I may or may not have ability at any given time, and then whether I'm sex favourable, neutral or averse is also fluid. It's become quite a complicated matrix.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you don't talk about it to people because where do you even start with someone who's never even heard of asexuality?
Yeah.
When you just know that they're going to jump to asking questions about your relationship. What we do is none of your business. I came out as not straight to all of my friends, and that was fine because they were all queer. I came out as not straight to my parents a couple of months before I thought there was a genuine prospect that I might date a girl.
Okay.
They didn't need to know until then, but I didn't. I just don't want any surprises for anyone here.
Yeah.
And then it was probably a year after that that I came out to them as non-binary because I wanted to do something about it.
Yeah. And where were you at that time? Were you still at school or were you working?
No, I was well out of school, well out of university, in the workforce, post-life collapse. They'd figured out at that point that you know, something was awry, but they didn't have any of the details in that sense. Okay. Yeah, I didn't talk to my family about it any younger. Partly because I didn't know about it myself, or because I didn't want to cause a fuss if I wasn't 100% certain that we were going to need to cause a fuss.
Yeah, okay.
I was very scared coming out to my parents about my transness in particular, only because of that experience with my aunt who had been estranged. In retrospect, it was not ill will on the basis of her gender or her transition. It was just that there were difficult family relationships. And I think we were in a culture where people didn't realise that it was unacceptable to use someone's identity against them when you didn't have a good relationship.
Yeah.
It would be great if, you know, the rest of society caught up with that concept. I had been in relationships before that were very unhealthy, various levels of toxic to abusive. And in all of those relationships, sex had become an issue. At the time, we put it down to the relationship problems and, you know, my health, meaning I wasn't, you know, physically capable. But I definitely internalized this sense that I was flawed that there was something very wrong with me, and that that thing that was wrong with me would result in the end of all of my important relationships. And that wasn't helped when I went to a psychiatrist one year asking for help in general, and he confirmed that I was broken and needed to be fixed, and tried to refer me to conversion practices. Didn't work, thankfully. But yeah, I had, and to a degree still have, this internalized sense that I am a problem in my relationships because I'm ace. And you see this discussion borne out in all of the asexual forums, subreddits, you know, any space where aces are talking to other aces. People will say, is it possible to have a relationship with another person who's not ace? And half the group will say, absolutely not, don't even bother, don't try, it'll always end in pain. And the other half say, no, we're... it can work. We can make it work. You've just got to find the right person. But you should never force yourself to do things that you're not comfortable with. That it's possible to be an ace person and stay within your own boundaries and have a fulfilling relationship. But those voices of it's always going to end badly, I think are louder because they echo what we're being told by society. Everything sells on sex. Everything, constantly. You know, whether it's explicit or not, there is this assumption in everything we experience in, you know, capitalism, I guess, that you're going to be attracted to sexual things or that sex is on your mind. To not engage with that naturally, you know, it builds a sense that you're missing something. And, yeah, I didn't realise that I was ace when Em and I got together. I figured it out a couple of years later, and I had to tangle with this sense that I'd tricked them or that I'd trapped them and that, you know, I love this person so much and here I was doomed to cause them pain, you know. And, you know, I made posts on various internet places, as you do when you need to unpack something. And, you know, people would say, oh, you should leave them now, you know, it'll be easier for both of you in the long run. It'll be less painful. Don't waste anyone's time. And I, you know, if I'm in ace spaces talking about being an ace in a relationship, I still hear that. And I go out into the world, and if I mention that I'm ace and my partner's not, I suffer from my perception of other people's judgment as much as I suffer from their actual judgment. And I think my aceness played into my religion growing up, because there's this religious ideal of the celibate person, and any tendencies towards aceness are just celebrated as you being such a good example of that virtue. So of course I didn't notice. I was being praised for it constantly, and I needed that praise. But yeah, I have started being more open in the last couple of years. I made a coming out post, I think, 2 years ago, and it was really difficult for me because I was scared on that people might judge, you know, Em as well as me. And I know that Em has had some quite difficult conversations with people we know about how we navigate our relationship in that sense. Yeah, that's not something that feels good.
You wouldn't have those conversations with people that don't tell you whether they're ace. Like, no one's ever talked to me and my partner about how we have sex or what our sex life is like or anything like that. It's so such a bizarre concept to me that people would be that curious, I guess. I don't know.
You can tell you're not trans. People ask what's in your pants constantly.
Yeah.
It's not only what again, what is not only what's in your pants, but what are you doing or not doing with it? Yeah, it's, and so that's still challenging, right?
Yeah.
And I think people who are in ethical non-monogamy arrangements might have a degree of sympathy to going out in the world and having a relationship structure that a lot of people just fundamentally do not understand. Because it is perceived much more as a choice than I think most of society, certain segments, accepted, have realized that being gay is not a choice. But being ace is seen as something that's curable medically. People say, well, you know, you can get pills for that. But your libido and your attraction are two separate things.
Yeah.
And being ace and moving in ace spaces has actually given me a really nuanced understanding of, I guess, attraction and romance and sexuality and how we talk about that. There's a lot of quite specific language in ace circles of, you know, there's the split attraction model, which is separating your romantic attraction from your sexual attraction. You might be romantically attracted to men and women, but only sexually attracted to men, or, you know, romantically attracted to everyone and sexually attracted to no one, or, you know, endless combinations thereof. And this separation of libido and sexual attraction, I have never heard anyone who wasn't ace talk about that difference. Mm. And I think I think navigating relationships as a teenager in general might be easier if someone used that language to talk to you when you were growing up. To say, okay, there's what your body wants, and then there's what the rest of you wants. And perhaps we should learn to tell the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. You've been in your current relationship for how long?
Oh, 7.5-ish years.
And how did you two meet?
We met through Trans Tas.
Okay.
The online Facebook group for trans people in Tasmania. My partner joined because they went to the first trans camp that happened, I think, 2016 maybe. And I joined because I was a friend of the founder. He said, hey, come join. And through that group, people were organising, you know, social get-togethers. And someone said, hey, I want to set up a trans Dungeons & Dragons group. And I went, sure, I'll go along to that. That sounds like fun. And the rest is history.
Yeah, amazing.
My partner likes to tell the story about how I sat down next to them that first session and, you know, they fell in love with me on the spot. I sat down next to them in the first session and went, there's no one here I'm interested in. And I think that probably says something about the difference in approach for, you know, potentially allosexual people versus asexual people. It was 6 months before I realized that I was attracted to M. And I didn't understand it when it happened. I'm like, why do I want to hold this person's hand? Crap, are we on a date? We're on a date. How did that happen? Oh, no. What am I going to do about that? It turned out fine.
Yeah, it seems to be. 7.5 years later.
And look, it was a protracted campaign on their part. They were very strategic. Mustn't rush me. Mustn't spook the asexual. They didn't know I was asexual at the time. But they could definitely tell I needed to not be spooked.
You want to maybe talk about the transition process and what that was like for you?
Yeah, because of my, I guess, multitudinous health issues and my remnant internalized transphobia, I was really intent to see, could I be satisfied in my female presenting body? You know, could I live happily in that body without having any medical interventions? I knew that I needed to have a social transition. I knew I needed, you know, they, them pronouns. I knew I needed to be non-binary on my birth certificate. But I wasn't sure if I would need to transition medically. And I spent a long time, so it was about 8 years between me coming out socially and transitioning socially and me starting my medical transition. And I think I was under pressure, explicit pressure from family to not do that because they saw it as, you know, a big risk. And in the end, I only managed to convince myself because I was convinced that it would help with my medical issues. And it did, enormously. I think even if I happened to have a, you know, 20-year-long gender fluid swing back to being female, I would probably stay on my testosterone because it does so much good for my health and well-being. As soon as I started testosterone, it became really obvious that it was what my body and brain had both needed all along. But there were many, many years of agonizing with psychiatrists and medical specialists and family before that going, but do I need it? Maybe I could explore a little bit more therapy. Maybe I could take that psychiatrist recommendation and go to acceptance therapy to accept my body. Jokes on him, I ended up talking to an acceptance and commitment therapy specialist. ACT, excellent therapy. 10 out of 10, recommend it to anyone. But yeah, I resisted it very hard because of the messaging from others external to me. And it took a very delicate and skilled therapist to allow me to admit that it was something I should at least explore. Yeah, and as soon as I did, my whole life changed vastly and in an accelerating way. And yeah, you know, I had this idea that I wanted top surgery. It came into my mind after I'd started HRT, and I'm like, yeah, actually, I think I would like that. I don't have a huge amount of body dysphoria, but I think I would be happier. And so off I went, and I got all the referrals and jumped through all of the psychiatrist and psychologist medical hoops to get the approvals, and I went off and I got top surgery. And the day after I woke up from that surgery, I realized it was like a huge weight had been cut out of my brain in that surgery, and I was so much lighter. Because I'd carried my dysphoria for so long, I didn't recognize it. Mm-hmm. And acknowledging it to myself before I'd had that top surgery would have been dangerous. I have this theory about dysphoria. It's that once you notice it, you can't look away. And so you can get along relatively functional in life until something forces you to notice the dysphoria. And as soon as you acknowledge it, it's right there, and you have to deal with it. And so when I wasn't in a position to get that top surgery, I couldn't afford to recognize that dysphoria. And so, yeah, it was only afterwards that I realized how much it had been affecting me. I think a lot of us who come out to ourselves in any way spend at least a while going back through our whole lives going and reinterpreting, you know, the things we've thought and said and done. And yeah, it's an endless process. There are still parts of my dysphoria that I don't talk about because I know that they're not an option for me in medical terms, and I can't afford to open that box. It sits there in a box in the back of my brain with a little label on it saying, dysphoria, do not open. but yeah, I think there's this illusion in society, even in community sometimes, that your transition and your coming out process is something that you can always bring to a natural conclusion that is the best possible realization of yourself. It's not always possible. You know, it's not always safe. It's not always viable for whatever reason. And there's a lot of having to be okay with things about yourself that comes with that. And I think that's also a complicating factor with, you know, asexuality. And, you know, those more knotty aspects of my identity is like, well, am I just accepting this because I don't think it can change? Do I want it to change? Should it change? And, you know, over the years I've settled down into, no, this is who I am. It may change in the future. It may be different eventually from how it is right now. But where I am right now, it's valid and it's who I am. So, you know, that's what I should be working with. And I think that's what everyone else needs to be working with me. I once tried to map all of this out on paper, unless you're into like advanced algebra and algorithms. It's probably a little bit terrifying.
Have there been any major instances of discrimination that you've had to fight against?
Big sigh. Where do we start? The one that sprang to mind was really the culmination of a lot that came before it. When I went to sexual health services and said, hey, I'm pretty sure I'm trans, can we do something about that? they told me that if I wanted to identify as non-binary, I quote, that I was doomed to eternal unhappiness if I expected society to accept me. That was a bit of a blow, but I am a bit oppositional at times. And so I made society accept me. I decided at that point that I was gonna do something. I didn't know what, I didn't know how, I didn't know with whom, but I was gonna be involved in getting birth certificate laws changed so that I could be non-binary on my birth certificate. Thank you very much. And we did that with the support of an enormous team of people led by Martine Delaney and Rodney Croom. You know, we got that done. It was agonizing. It was traumatic. And as one of the spokespeople for that campaign, there were three spokespeople. As one of the spokespeople, I had letters written anonymously to my employer accusing me of being a sexual predator, of being violent and dangerous, of accusing me of libel and... Oh, you know, I've actually forgotten all of the things that I was accused of in letters to my employer in the hope that I would get fired. Thankfully, I had an employer who didn't have time for all of that. You know, I mentioned just the other night to my friends when I was at a crochet group. Oh, you know, just had to block another transphobe harassing me in my DMs. And they're like, what do you mean someone's harassing you in your DMs? I'm like, well, what do you mean? Of course people harass me in my DMs. Of course you don't get that. No, I'm just publicly trans. And so you get harassed in your DMs. But towards the end of that law reform campaign, I was sitting in the gallery in the upper house for 2 weeks straight, from open till close, which was sometimes, you know, 8 a.m. to 9:30 or 10 p.m. because someone had to be there to remind the people debating on the floor that there was a human face attached to that. And also I was, you know, doing work on my laptop and on my phone, sending things to our supporters, adapting the amendments, all sorts of things in the background, finding references, finding responses. But what it meant was that in that week, our detractors in the upper house, under parliamentary privilege, they spouted some pretty atrocious things about trans people and who they thought we were. And I was the name that and face that they attached to it. So I was sitting there in the gallery while our elected representatives called me personally dangerous, called me personally a predator, under parliamentary privilege with no right of reply. I just had to sit there and take it because I knew that I was sitting there for every other trans person in the state, and someone had to be sitting there, so it was me.
That's a lot to put on your shoulders.
Oh, yeah, it was traumatic. I go to therapy about it still. But I think it goes to show that degree of discrimination and bigotry, it's considered acceptable by, you know, half of our elected representatives to say that out loud explicitly in front of someone, let alone the systemic stuff that we face, let alone all of the microaggressions or exclusion or, you know. Mm. I think a lot of us don't even notice a lot of the discrimination because we've become so used to it, which is really sad when you think about it, but... Then I look at all of the change that's happened just in the 5 years since we got that through.
Hmm.
And, you know, it was absolutely worth it, every bit. And then you look at all of the change in the 30 years since that UN decision again on the Tasmanian anti-gay rights, anti-gay laws. And you look at all the change that's happened since then, you know. My campaign was child's play compared to that one. Right?
Mm.
We've made so much progress. getting harassed in my DMs is, yeah, small price to pay for that.
I think there's also, I guess, a bit of a pushback that we've seen against trans and gender diverse people, especially young people. How do you feel about that being kind of a response to progression.
I have mixed feelings about that, in the sense that I have different feelings from day to day, depending on how resilient I am. When I'm feeling resilient, I tell myself that the backlash is the dying gasps of someone who knows they're losing. Mm-hmm. Of course there's a backlash, you know. Of course they're fighting because they're cornered and we've made so much ground. Any cornered animal is going to go out like that, but it means that we're winning. On my less resilient days, you know, I look at the legal changes that have happened in the US and I look at the cultural trends in Australia to try and be like the US and the UK. And it can feel pretty bleak. You know, I think often of the Hirschfeld Institute in Germany during the Holocaust, where Germany was the leading place in the world for trans rights, trans research, you know, queer research. And it was a haven. And it was somewhere that people moved from all over the world to be. And then within the space of a few short years, there was a Holocaust against us. And the Institute was burned to the ground and all of its books were burned. And I think, even if I think, you know, this conservative anti-human rights backlash is a dying animal, we can't afford to get lax. We cannot allow the sort of reactionary backlash that we're seeing to get traction. And we have to have zero tolerance for intolerance, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
The way that I keep myself emotionally healthy around the TERF madness is that I live in the country in a queer disabled household, in a little queer disabled community. Our neighbours on both sides are also queer and disabled. And we all look after each other. And we swap vegetables and mend each other's clothes and look out for each other. And it's so healing to lean into the real, the powerful meaning of community, not just community in the way we talk about, oh, the queer community, but community in the sense of looking after each other and respecting each other and looking out for each other, even if you don't necessarily get along personally, even if you don't necessarily agree on things. This shared responsibility and care for each other, that is work, but it's so healing. And I would love for our communities across the entire rainbow spectrum to really look at what, you know, what community means, what it meant before it was a label for a group of people who shared a characteristic, when it was a group of people who had compassion and understanding and responsibility to each other. Something that I have been really loving over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years of my life particularly, is how inextricable my disability identity and my queer identity are from each other. I do advocacy in both of those spaces and I do work in both of those spaces, but in myself, there's no distinction. There's a kind of anarchistic rebellion against societal norms and societal expectations that's the same thing between those two groups. And there's this intense pressure when you're one or the other, or both, to be as normal as you can in every other way. There's a lot of disabled people who will never admit that they are queer in disabled spaces, or queer people who will never admit that they're disabled in disabled spaces. I read a poem a couple of months ago by a deaf lesbian woman, and she said, "I'm too deaf for the lesbians and I'm too lesbian for the deafs." But her understanding of her own identity was that the two things weren't separable, and mine is the same. You know, I really believe in the power of labels and micro-labels for people to take ownership of themselves and understand that they are not broken and not wrong, and that there are other people who have had that very specific, particular experience. But I also love letting go of all of that and going, you can't take my disability, away from my transness, away from my aceness, they're all tied in together. You can't say that one part of it is treatable and the other isn't. Either society is going to accept me and my needs, or it's not.
If you could go back to a time where you felt vulnerable, what message of hope or encouragement would you give yourself?
I'm thinking of myself when I was, 15, 16 years old, sitting with my headphones on in the back of the classroom, trying not to exist. And I don't know if there's any message I could bring myself that I would believe. So I think instead I would have just gone back to sit with myself and be there and say, look, I know what's going on inside and I'm going to hold space for you to feel that.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story and talking today. I really, really appreciate you taking the time and being so open. So thank you so much.
Really appreciate what you're doing. Thank you.
If this episode has raised any issues for you, please take some time to reflect and ensure you reach out for support if you need it. If you are listening in Tasmania, you can contact Working It Out via their website or calling 6231 1200 during business hours. If you need immediate mental health support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224636. Both services are available 24/7. If you would like to get in touch or share your story on this podcast, please send us an email at nwpride@outlook.com. This podcast is produced by Northwest Pride, a community group based across the north, northwest and west coast of Tasmania. They host events and social inclusion opportunities for anyone who is a part of the LGBTIAQ+ community, their friends and allies. This podcast is made possible by the support of Working It Out. You can hear future episodes and all of our past episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Please follow, rate, and review if you can. It does help us to reach more folks who might enjoy or benefit from hearing these amazing life stories. We'll be back soon. Take care of yourself and each other.